The countries that don't embrace Bitcoin will, at the end of the day, suffer. Their industries will fall, their governments will fall, their currencies will devalue, and it'll be what it is. You know, they'll be struggling. So I really am optimistic for Bitcoin to give people that choice for the very first time.
Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin. Swan is Bitcoin made easy. We have automatic buys, instant buys, automatic withdrawals, and super fast account creation. You can go from zero to Bitcoin in 3 minutes. Check it out at swanbitcoin.com. I'm your host, Brady Swenson, head of education at Swan. Swan Signal Live, this show, pairs up great guests for compelling discussions about Bitcoin and economics. This one is no exception. We have with us Nick Bhatia, author of the forthcoming book, Layered Money, and Jan Pritzker, author of Inventing Bitcoin and co-founder, CTO of Swan Bitcoin. Glad you found your way here. Enjoy.
I think we're live.
All right, there we are. We have our first viewers. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Swan Signal Live, the first episode of 2021. And it is going to be an absolutely epic year for Bitcoin, for Swan Signal Live, for Swan itself. We have a great show to kick off the year with Nick Bhatia and Jan Pritzker. And we're going to get to that just a minute as until first I'm going to shill Swan here for just a second. Like I said, it's going to be a great year for Swan. We're really looking forward to it. We ended 2020 on an amazing note. It was an amazing year for Swan. We've been up and running for about, 10 months now. Haven't even been around for a full year. Absolutely blown away by the support, by the traction, by, you know, the customers coming in, learning about Bitcoin, accumulating Bitcoin, and this is the time to do it. So get your friends and family on board. You can do that with a referral code, so you can stack sats while they're stacking sats at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. The Swan Force is growing strong and steadily and really taking off as well. So grab that referral code and then recruit your family and friends. Selling them on Bitcoin is a little bit easier now than it has been because number has been going up and it continues to go up. We saw a bit of a dip and it was bought right back up. And I think we're going to be continuing to see that throughout this cycle as big, you know, companies, corporations, governments start holding Bitcoin as a reserve asset. So let's talk some more Bitcoin with Jan and Nick today. Guys, welcome to the show. I'm really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thanks, Brady. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Nick, you have a new book, Layered Money, and it's going to drop pretty soon, right? In a couple of weeks?
Yeah, just a couple of weeks, January 26th. Going to try to sneak it out a couple days early if I can.
Yeah, that's exciting. And I took gave it a read last night, and it was a fantastic just journey through the evolution of money, what money really is, and where we are today in terms of this stack of layered money. Has it evolved throughout history and became a very complex stack that we have now? And I'd love to talk about the evolution of money and how it's developed into the stack that we have today. This kind of overcomplication of money that we have now, like you describe it as a doctorate level economic theory that required to try to understand conventionally what we think money is today. So that lack of understanding led to the development of this book. And you've kind of taken this idea of layers that Bitcoiners talk about in terms of protocol layers, right? Like the base layer of the protocol, Lightning is the second layer of the protocol, et cetera, and applied it to money. And I think that's really useful. Can you just talk about the idea of this language of layered money for just a second?
Sure. So part of the inspiration for it actually comes from a 2012 paper in Financial Academia called The Inherent Hierarchy of Money. And the paper talks about how money is inherently hierarchical because money started with metal and then promises to pay metal. And the hierarchy in that relationship is that we have gold, physical gold, on the first layer of money and promises to pay gold, like gold certificates or gold deposits, on the second layer of money. And so I applied that framework to history to the dollar today, and then it naturally fits in with Bitcoin because we all think of it as the base layer for online transfer of value.
Yeah, Jan, you are a Bitcoiner, of course, and a software developer in general as CTO at Swan Bitcoin and co-founder. So I assume that this sort of understanding of describing money as layered comes sort of intuitive to you. What do you think about this terminology that Nick's laying out in this book in a more formal way?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think a lot of people who are new to Bitcoin and even people who have been around for a while who first thought of Bitcoin as a payment system always ask questions like, you know, will it ever scale to be Visa? Will it do that kind of traffic volume? How can it ever do that kind of traffic volume? And for me, you know, as a software developer, obviously, you know, I'm very familiar with building systems and layers. What software developers do a lot of times is they make trade-offs, right? You can't have this one thing that does everything perfectly. You're always making some type of trade-off because typically you have a constraint on how fast something can go, how much memory or space it can use. You know, you're making those trade-offs. With money, you know, whenever I heard people talk about Visa or PayPal and how many transactions per second they can do, it's very obvious to me that what they're transacting is not money, right? I think if you're a software developer, you know that, and if you're a money person, you know that. But a lot of people in the middle maybe don't know those things, that what Visa and PayPal and even your bank, what they're moving around are numbers in a database. So it's already a layer above physical money, which maybe is cash dollars or a settlement through SWIFT or the Federal Reserve. Maybe you can consider that base money. I think Nick goes even further in saying that actually base money is gold, and then everything else that was built on top of it over time, you know, created layers. But then that base layer was yanked out from under us, right? With the demolition of the gold standard. But yes, all monies or all computer systems and all monetary computer systems especially are built in layers because they optimize for different things. So with Visa, we're optimizing for speed. We want to have a lot of transactions, but we're not actually going to settle that money until maybe 30 days later or much later through one transaction that pushes all that money from one bank to another. And the concern there, for example, might be around, you know, did the money actually exist in those accounts or not? And only later do you find out that you didn't have the money, right? So layered systems make different trade-offs. You have speed at one side and then like veracity or authenticity of the transaction that might happen much, much later. And with Bitcoin, it's very much similar, where the Bitcoin base layer actually has the concerns of like, is Bitcoin being transacted correctly? Is it valid? Is it authentic? Is it not counterfeit? You know, has it not been double spent? But it's concern, those concerns are one thing. And then they have the concern of speed, which might happen at a different layer, which could be something like the Lightning Network or other second layer solutions.
Fantastic. Nick, do you want to build off of that at all?
Yeah, Jan is absolutely correct. You know, the layered terminology can apply to money. It can apply to the relationship between these balance sheets of where the money comes from. It applies to the protocol of Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, how that's a, you know, first and second layer relationship. And Jan is absolutely correct that different layers serve different purposes. And so what we have with Bitcoin is a first layer money that anybody can access. You're going to have to wait a little bit on in terms of your settlement. And by a little bit, I mean just a few minutes to settle that. And if you want instant settlement, you're going to have to go to a different layer, like he was talking about with Visa and MasterCard. They don't transact first layer money or even second layer money in my framework. They're transacting on much lower layers of money.
So Nick, you, like I said at the top, you go through the evolution of money, the history of money, which is fascinating. And you know, anyone who's gone through Neil Ferguson's tome will understand that there's a lot there, obviously. It's a fundamental technology of human civilization. And you have condensed it down into a much more approachable, 50 pages or so, which I definitely appreciate. And I think you did a fantastic job. Would you mind summarizing I want to get into talking about Venice and Antwerp and kind of focusing on those and digging a little deeper into those stories. But could you kind of bring us up to that point, up to the 12th, 13th century on the history of money with a little summary?
Yeah. So, you know, the history of money can go all the way back to the history of human anthropology. Sapiens talks a little bit about this stuff and Niall Ferguson as well in his book, The Ascent of Money. But what I wanted to do is start at the gold coin. The reason I chose that is because I think that why humans chose gold is a very interesting anthropological study and can really go back many, many millennia. But I didn't want to start all the way back there. I wanted to start with once humans chose gold and silver as the best forms of money and the consensus forms of money really around the world, how did a monetary system develop after that? And really, it got kickstarted with coins and taking this idea of using precious metal and then standardizing its weight and measure so it could be used a lot quicker than if we were just going to trade gold necklaces or gold nuggets that, you know, we would have to weigh and measure the purity every single time we transacted. So coins really simplified that a lot. And we saw the first coins in around the 6th, 7th century BC. And then the first coin that I think really kickstarts the monetary system aspect of it is the gold florin issued by Florence in the 13th century. And that's the first coin that we really focus on.
Yeah. So what made the florin special or different from, you know, we had a couple thousand years of coinage running up to then? What changed the game?
It's something that's familiar to Bitcoiners. It's the fact that it wasn't devalued at all for over 300 years. And that was remarkable and unprecedented. And it really allowed people around Europe to gravitate around the florin as an accounting denomination, as a way to store value long-term, and as a way to also, more importantly, as a way to build a layer of promises. So a second layer of money based off of this very consistent coin of the gold florin.
I think it's interesting because with Bitcoin, we basically get that for free, right? We have the ability to assay both, not just in each individual coin, which is very easy. You know, your full node validates each coin that you receive, but we also have the ability to determine the entire world supply of Bitcoin, making sure that there's no new Bitcoins being produced. So it's very interesting to see those parallels between Bitcoin and physical coins that were considered very good. And now we have this even like bigger leap in technology, allowing us to have much more confidence in the purity and quantity of those coins.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, I think through my research and I think most Bitcoiners as well, that Satoshi's design was very specific and it was as intended. He talked about gold, he talked about gold mining. He had an acute awareness of the monetary system, credit-based monetary systems, fiat currencies, which means currencies that aren't backed by anything other than decree or promises. And in his early literature, he talked about all these things. And so it is appropriate for us to draw parallels to thousands of years of gold history in order to describe Bitcoin and its role in the future of money.
That's a good point there that Jan raises, right? The ability to assay the money itself and the veracity of it, the hardness of it, the truth of the ledger. And in terms of like relating it back to gold, gold itself is and has been throughout history very difficult to assay. So what are some of the ways, Nick, that the people would try to, you know, establish the, you know, like, I guess, quality of a gold coin in the past?
You have to, it comes down to either you trust that it is what it is and you transact quickly, or you don't trust and you slow down the entire concept of money velocity or economic activity. And so people basically were forced to trust this, new type of gold. And they used their belief in the face on the coin, the ruler, the government, that, you know, these coins were of a certain purity. And once enough people believed that the coins were legitimate and they had their, you know, purity, then it allowed for economic activity to increase. But really, when it comes down to it, if we want to draw the parallel to Bitcoin, people weren't verifying every transaction. They weren't weighing and testing the purity of every gold coin that they, or silver coin that they transacted with. And because it's burdensome, it takes time, it takes money, and it's just not realistic. But in Bitcoin, we have this ability to do that instantly. And that's part of the revolution.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting to talk about, a lot of people believe that that money's not possible without government. And they will even say things like, even if, you know, the gold wasn't chosen freely, it was only when governments were like stamping their faces on it to create that, guarantee of purity and all that, that people were able to use that as money. Where with Bitcoin, we actually have kind of a revolution in that. Whether or not it's true that governments were a prerequisite for money, we don't have to make that determination, because Bitcoin actually makes that possible without governments, because we can, each one of us, say, the quantity and the quality of the coin without any third party. That's the whole point, right? And I think that makes a really interesting, it is a parallel to the purity of the coin idea that you just talked about, Nick. But I do think it also creates this big leap in our understanding of money, because we can now say, for the first time, we can, believe in the purity of something, just not through belief, but through verification.
And on the first layer, more specifically, like on the first layer, not just because, if you take a stable coin, for example, even if it's on a ledger and we can verify that we have that stable coin, we still are disconnected from the money, because of a balance sheet that exists between us and, probably at least one balance sheet exists between us and the money itself. And so with Bitcoin, we leapfrog over all of those balance sheet relationships. And that is extremely powerful. And, the point of the book was to explain that Bitcoin is a new first layer money, not just a new type of money or a new technology. It's a new first layer money that people can have access to anywhere in the world, giving them really an unprecedented, monetary authority. And, it's really exciting. I'm so excited for the book to come out, just days away now.
So what is, can we even say the money supply of like the current US dollar money supply? Is it just like, do we round it off at some point? Do we know an exact number, Nick, of the number of dollars that are in circulation? Let's say M1 or M2.
Sure. It's a great point. So, I think that M1 and M2 are completely obsolete. It's part of the reason I introduced this layered framework. So we can measure different layers, the quantity of money on different layers with different degrees of accuracy. And accuracy is the best word. On the first layer in the US dollar pyramid, in my book, I have US treasuries alone by themselves. And so we can measure the quantity of U.S. treasuries in the system. It's about $30 trillion today. On the second layer of money, it's starting to get a little bit more difficult, because not only does the Fed issue reserves to the banking system and cash, both of which we can measure, they also issue foreign exchange swap lines to other central banks, and how those central banks use that money to propagate it through their own domestic banking systems is also very hard to measure, by the Fed. And then on the third layer of money, which is bank deposits here in the United States, that's also measurable. But, once you start to get into lower layers of money, it becomes very, very difficult.
You also have dollar creation through the creation of debt, right? That may be completely outside of the purview of the Fed, the euro dollar system, where people are creating dollar denominated debt in other countries, also creates money in a sense that we can really not track at all.
It's not in a sense, it is money that they are creating. Yes. And yes, so when I say bank deposits are created when loans are issued. And that's the double entry accounting. It's when a loan is issued, it becomes an asset on a bank's balance sheet, and it issues a deposit, which becomes their liability. It becomes your money. It becomes your asset, but it's their liability. And so layers also, you know, is a way to describe the balance sheet relationship.
So that's double entry accounting system was really created in Venice around the time that the florin was established. And so let's go back to Venice in the 13th century. Can you talk about the advent of, you know, maybe not the exact advent, right? But the popularization, the spread of double entry bookkeeping accounting.
Right. So I wouldn't say it was created in Venice, but the practices that were brought to Europe from the Middle East and India over time were formalized in Venice with double entry account, the double entry accounting system. And what that did is it really allowed this banker class to develop and then start issuing promises with each other and loans and doing this to make money, of course. That was their goal. And they all did so on a level playing field, meaning they were all using the same accounting rules. And they were all able to compete with each other following these same mathematical rules. And I do believe that double entry accounting and its formalization at that time in Venice were key to progressing money away from just a metal and really toward a system, which, you know, we see today. We're not using coins to transact with each other. We use a monetary system. So double entry accounting was a huge foundation in that development.
Was this also the point where second layer monies were really used more widely?
Exactly. So because the florin was used as this kind of ultimate settlement, it allowed, I wouldn't say that the relationship is direct between the florin and this boom of second layer money, but it did contribute to it. People believed that if they had a bill of exchange that promised them florins in the future, that bill of exchange had value, that, you know, that promise that was made that they held did have value. And those promises that held value, you know, they gained popularity. They gained a rhythm, actually, if you want to use that word, because the bills of exchange were designed to bridge maturity. They were designed to bridge debts between these seasonal fairs across Europe. And so, you know, for the next 3 months, I owe you this. And for the next 3 months, you owe me that. And that relationship of, you know, kind of 3 month maturities stayed for a couple centuries. But then in Antwerp, finally, in the 16th century, we found all those promises and pieces of paper leaving the quarterly world and coming into a live market. And that's where the money market was born in Antwerp in 1531.
Definitely want to get into that because it's a really interesting story that you lay out in the book. It was holding my attention because I hadn't really heard the story. So definitely had me wrapped. Jan, Bitcoin is often referred to as a triple entry accounting system, maybe the first triple entry accounting system. Can you talk about why we say that the Bitcoin might have added an entry to the accounting system?
Well, you know, with double entry accounting, we have to really just trust the two copies of the ledger, right? We have like the liabilities and the assets, and we have, you know, that written in each person's balance sheet. But now we also have this like third party, totally incorruptible ledger, right? Where this thing is stamped into. So if I own one BTC, if I've received one BTC from Nick, then that receipt is stamped into the blockchain. That's neither his entry nor my entry. It's completely you know, impartial entity, if you will, that is recording the ownership of that Bitcoin. It's incorruptible, which is actually for the first time, you know, in history do we have this idea that we can store an incorruptible record of something. Which is then buried under what we call proof of work, right? With Bitcoin mining, with people expending lots and lots of energy in order to secure that record. So I know that that Bitcoin is mine, and Nick knows that that Bitcoin is mine, and it is what it is. You know, it can't be changed. I think it's a really important innovation, not just for accounting, but just the idea of property rights, because now, you know, this, it can't be taken away from me. You know, I'm the only one that has the keys to that, to spend that coin in the future, which is a really, really big innovation. And I think it's going to propel the use of money in ways that we haven't really thought about yet, because, you know, it opens up all these doors for us. It's not just that I could have keys to that. It could be a multi-signature address where I'm sharing the keys with some other people. It could be a corporate entity that where the keys are shared by 7 of 9 holders or something like that. So I think this is a very interesting system that we've just discovered, and we're just starting to understand the possibility of it. And with more things coming down the line, like Taproot, which would potentially open us up to doing more complex, more complex scripts and things like that to lock up our coins, we really are going to get into a world where it's not just a ledger. You know, it's much more than that. It really opens up the opportunities for us to create contracts with each other that we haven't even explored.
Nick, what is the impact of this idea of triple entry accounting to you?
It's formative. It means that the relationship between balance sheets is really replaced by a shared record, like Jan was saying. It's everybody has the record. That's the third entry. I have it because I have a node. You have it because you have a node. But then everybody else has it because they also have nodes, and we share a common history, backwards looking 10 to 20 minutes. And that is the triple entry, and it's very powerful.
A trustless double entry accounting system, another innovation. Okay, so let's dive back into history. The 16th century in Antwerp, in the Netherlands. And this was, like you were starting to get into, where the first money market developed for second layer money. So second layer money being traded. And this had a big impact on the velocity of money and the ability for markets to really grow. And so I'd love to hear some color on this story, Nick.
Yes. So it's actually before the money market arrived in the Netherlands. Antwerp was the center of international trade. And so that means, you know, all the commodities were traded through Antwerp. And because of that, the bankers followed the traders and the merchants around and helped them bridge debts and transfer money around the continent. And those forms of banker promises that were made during that time found their way onto an exchange where the pieces of paper themselves began to be traded. And that's where the idea of money in terms of promises having time value. And so the time value of money, really, we saw it for the first time on a daily basis in Antwerp. You could measure the time value of money by measuring an interest rate over a year. You know, if someone is paying debt and they, you know, promise to pay it back in 12 months. But if you have 3 months promises that are changing hands every day, you actually, the time value of money was born in that Antwerp bourse. And that's why I had to include it in the story of layered money, because when money got a time value, we knew that this second layer money was an asset class of itself. And people were going to trade it and try to make money off of it and arbitrage it. And so the demand for it was real. And that would continue on.
So can you talk a little bit more about the time value of money? You wrote this, the first, I think, maybe way people were introduced in Bitcoin world to your work was, I think it was 2018, maybe 2017.
2018,
right around the launch of mainnet Lightning Network. You wrote about the Lightning Network as a layer two money on top of Bitcoin's base money, establishing a time value for Bitcoin. So can you talk about the importance of that for Bitcoin in particular? You've talked about it as a, you know, as it is, you know, relates to money. What will that do for Bitcoin in particular, though?
So Bitcoin is unique in that it doesn't need a time value or the Lightning Network to be an important technology. Bitcoin as a neutral money is a once in a millennia, several millennia type of technology, and it's important because of that by itself. However, the Lightning Network allows Bitcoin to be used in a much more dynamic way than without it. So in the Lightning Network, there is a secondary network of Bitcoiners themselves that have agreed with these contracts, these smart contracts, to transact with each other instantly, because they all agreed that they were going to bring real Bitcoin into the system and use these standardized contracts in the Lightning Network. And anybody that dedicates Bitcoin to this network can earn Bitcoin by helping other people transact. And that's, you know, goes into payment channels and liquidity. But really the point is that if you can dedicate Bitcoin to the Lightning Network, earn an income denominated in BTC, but you didn't have to actually fork over that Bitcoin at any point. It was just locked in these smart contracts that you could close at any time and call the funds back to yourself. We have, for the first time ever in monetary history, the ability to earn income without ever having to relinquish the capital required. And that is something that's very exciting and new in monetary history. And the interest rate that we can derive from that type of routing activity, it's my belief, can be used as a reference rate for Bitcoin when we start to see capital markets really take off and people borrowing in Bitcoin terms. They'll always have to pay a premium to Lightning Network reference rate, in my opinion. Nobody will ever lend you money and at a lower interest rate than what they can earn in a Lightning node, for example. That's my opinion. I think that that's far off, maybe a couple of years away until we can actually see how these interest rates are relate to each other. But it's part of my thesis and prediction, and it's really why I started writing about Bitcoin, was to discuss this idea publicly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal, and I agree with you that we're seeing it happen now, and we'll see it play out over the next few years. Lightning Network is still only a few years old at this point. Jan, can you talk about this idea of Lightning Network producing a yield curve, creating a yield curve through returns? I know that we're seeing some development on that front now. It's making it a lot easier to earn yield on money that you have locked up on, or freed up, as you might say, on the Lightning Network with Lightning Pool, for instance. Do you want to talk a little bit about the developments on that front on the Lightning Network?
I'll probably have to defer to Nick primarily on that, as I haven't been following it as closely as I should be. But I will comment on something that I saw Alex Bosworth tweet a few weeks ago, I think it was, where he was showing his stats around how many Lightning payments he had routed from over the last couple of years, and basically like how many payments he had routed and how much he had earned on routing them. And there was essentially an exponential looking growth to that, which is as would be expected. I think Lightning Network is super young right now. There's a lot of impatience, especially in the altcoin community, around Lightning isn't real, it's never going to work, but it's been working and it's been growing. And I think what's actually happening is it's just so early in Bitcoin that there's just not enough Bitcoin circulated yet, not enough Bitcoin locked into the Lightning Network yet. As that grows, we are going to see an exponential increase in the ability to route payments and to earn yield from that, which I think is very interesting, as Nick is pointing out, because it is essentially a risk-free, or as close to risk-free as you can get with lending your Bitcoin. And I think there's two forces there, where you have, you can lend your Bitcoin to a third party completely custodially, right? Like I can just literally send my Bitcoin to somebody and with no promise of ever seeing it back other than maybe like a legal piece of paper. Or I can do something like an unchained capital thing where I lock it up and it's on-chain and I can see it and it's more a little bit more transparent. Or I have that ability to lend it to the Lightning Network for essentially a risk-free rate where I can always call it back, modulo, like if the Lightning Network has bugs, then there might be a problem there. But generally speaking, over time, we do expect that to be a risk-free rate. And so, yeah, I think it's a very exciting development. I think with Bitcoin, one thing that I'm not really, maybe don't have a clear understanding on is what it's going to look like because Bitcoin's total supply is fixed. So at some future point where all the supply is distributed, if somebody's earning yield, that necessarily means that somebody else has paid them that money. It hasn't come from new issuance or anything else. So it'll be interesting to see how those fee markets and routing markets develop given that information. But I do think it's a very, like Nick said, why would I ever lend to somebody when I can just earn X percent risk-free? I would have to ask for a lot more in yield from somebody else if that's the case. So I think we are going to see that developing. I think it's very, very early. I feel like I'm the conservative one. I'm always like, it's a generation away before anybody uses this stuff. But if it's you know, in the next 2 to 5 years, I think it'd be very exciting as well.
Yeah. And also, you know, from my perspective, I'm geeking out about the fact that there will be a rate and that we'll be able to measure the difference. People at the beginning, the most frequent question I would get is, how much do you think the interest rate will be, or how much do you think that we can earn? And that part is less interesting to me. It's the fact that you can, and that you do it only with smart contracts and without actually having to relinquish the Bitcoin, and that there is income and there is demand for channel liquidity. I saw that myself working at OpenNode when I was doing research with those guys. I saw firsthand how they manage a node, and it is a skill set. First of all, it definitely takes expertise. The way that those guys run the node, it takes iteration. So, you know, they're always doing A/B testing, you know, what works for routing fees and what doesn't. And, if you want, you know, if you ever want to understand more on what goes into, you know, a node, talk to the businesses that are building Lightning Network companies and themselves are the biggest nodes in the network. And we can see that, you know, with OpenNode and Fold and these guys, they are experts in the functioning of the Lightning Network itself. And so there's a lot happening, regardless really of how much they can earn by routing fees.
Go ahead, Jan.
I was going to just say, I think it's also very early in the user experience of Lightning node operation, where you do have to have a lot of expertise. You have to understand the network. You have to understand how to manage your liquidity. And I think we're already seeing developments on this front from companies that are developing products to essentially help you manage that and have it more automatic. And I think as that gets out, you know, to the mainstream, we're going to be able to all run routing nodes and maybe earn different amounts of yield depending on how savvy we are. But I do expect with more technology and more, maybe there's machine learning or something like that that helps you optimize these things. And over time, we'll have more people entering to that space, more businesses doing it. Maybe it'll end up being that if you're just a point of sale merchant and you're running a Lightning node to accept payments for your business, that you're also a routing node and you're earning yield on that, which would be very cool. But I do think we're just some way away from that just because of the technology that's required to develop all of that.
And part of the challenge for me is that I don't have a programming expertise at all. So when I read, you know, the papers from Lightning Labs, a lot of it still goes over my head until time goes by and people like Alex Bosworth start tweeting about it. And, you know, that's how we can learn, you know, these things. And especially me with a financial background, the what it means for liquidity and capital markets and interest rates is all very exciting, but we have to wait for the programmers and for the products to be tested. And once they're tested and they work, then people actually start talking about them in more of a layman's term that I can understand.
Yeah. And by the way, I found that tweet. So this is just interesting statistics. So he said in 2018, he routed 5,000 payments, earned $20. In 2019, it was 15,000 payments, so about three times as much, but here in $200, so much bigger yield. And in 2020, he routed 70,000 payments, earned $2,500. So we could definitely see that yield is increasing. I think, I don't know if I can do the math in my head on 70,000 divided by 2,500.
No, it's actually, you can't measure it because it's the number of transactions. It's, right. You know, it comes down to how much liquidity that he dedicated to the network. But the bottom line is that the pie is getting bigger.
Yep.
You know, as more people start using it.
Yeah. Do you have have you achieved that kind of high level layman's understanding of Lightning Pool yet? It's a few months old. Lightning Labs announced it as a way to more easily generate liquidity by basically lending out your Bitcoin on the Lightning Network to others who need to open channels.
Yeah, I actually understood it when I spoke with Ryan Gentry at Lightning Labs, and I had a chat with him, and he explained it to me as, I really like this, as like a capital lease. And so, you know, I think when I think of capital lease, I think of John Deere and Caterpillar, and that's the analogy. So when they lease you the tractor, you're using the tractor for your utility. And so the payment channel, I think of it like as a tractor, maybe. And that doesn't fit in the financial world yet, but I'll have to come up with a better analogy. But yeah, I think of it as a capital lease. And so the channel that itself is a commodity, is a financial commodity, like a tractor. That can earn you something from it, and the channels themselves are liquidity instruments, to my understanding. But it's gonna, again, like, I'm not able to understand it yet. I have to see people use it, and then I can come up with analogies that make it more translatable into financial jargon.
Yeah, and I think it's just early with the user experience again, because right now, even to participate in this, you need to run like a command line client. I mean, most people are not going to be savvy enough to do that. I do expect over time they're going to create products around this, you know, productize it, make it really easy to use, and we will see more businesses enter into the space and actually become operators of nodes and lending to this pool concept. And I think it's just early, but we're going to see it.
And I will also say that my confidence in the people that are designing these things is so sky high that I don't even worry that much. I know that as time passes, they will be creating amazing things that are then translated into layman terms for people like me. And I know this just from like what Lightning Labs has done over the last 2 years. You know, you start with a few tweets by Alex Bosworth about routing payments, and it's, you know, we can geek out about it from an interest rate perspective and capital markets perspective. And then a year later, they are launching a capital lease platform with payment channels that you can earn Bitcoin. And it's like a plug and play solution to people that have the technical expertise. It's mind blowing. It's going so fast. I trust that they're building it for us. And you know, it's just empirical. We can look and see that they are. So I'm excited to see what the Lightning Labs team has in store for us and every other company out there that is employing Bitcoin Lightning Network developers and designers for our user experience.
And speaking of layers, we also have a layer emerging on top of Lightning Network now, layer 3 protocols and networks that are being developed, like RGB, which allows you to tokenize Bitcoin, and Atomic.Finance, I believe, is creating using some contracts, DLC contracts, to create financial contracts and services. Eventually, I think they're starting out with a betting service, a trustless betting service on top of Lightning Network. Jan, do you have any other, or Nick, do you have any other like projects that you've noticed that are emerging on Layer 3, which is really the cutting edge, I think, of Bitcoin development right now?
So I saw that Counter-Strike is now using something, you know, along the lines of a Lightning Network enabled payment system. So that's something that I'm extremely excited to look into. A friend of mine pointed that out to me, so I have to dive into that. But it's, you know, to me, it's just an application of streaming money, and the way that we can use Lightning is it's so much more usable than Bitcoin in online scenarios. You know, Bitcoin is a slow settlement for first layer money, and we need that. And Lightning enables everything else. So I'm really excited.
Yeah. Jan, did you want to shout out any projects that
I've been loosely tracking Jeremy Rubin's POW swap project, which is like the idea that you can have hash rate derivatives that you trade on chain, which is pretty interesting. To me, Bitcoin is the future of money. And as such, every single financial product that we have today, plus lots that we can't even imagine, will exist in some form, whether It's from fully trustless by using like, on-chain contracts or lightning contracts to like maybe even semi-custodial or even fully custodial, right? Because there are still trusted institutions that we would use, such as a Bitcoin bank, quote unquote, right? That might manage some of these things for us. So I think it's very interesting that we can choose which layer we want to have these things operate at and make different trade-offs. Maybe we want to have something that operates really, really, really fast and, you know, that could be fully custodial or lightning. Or we want something that has extreme trust guarantees, which we could do on the base layer with some scripting. I think it's very interesting that Bitcoin does offer us this layered system where we can design these concepts at the appropriate layer. And we're going to see this evolve in ways that we can't even imagine. I'm very excited about it.
Me too. All right, before we continue on with this episode, I just want to take a moment to thank all of you for watching today. Ask you to go ahead and like and subscribe to the channel, like this video right now, and subscribe to the Swan Signal channel on YouTube. We do a lot of great Bitcoin content like this show here. We also host a show called Swan Lounge, which is a little bit more laid back. We talk about the news of the week and just kind of hang out. And you'll catch those here. We publish other content like Jan has a series called Just Talking About Bitcoin, 2-3 minute videos addressing basic questions, 50-60 questions. That's in a playlist on this channel as well. We'll continue to put out great Bitcoin content, educational content. You can send your friends and family to this channel, youtube.com/swansignal, to help them kind of learn about what's going on. That Jan playlist is a really great one to start with. We also have a playlist with Robert Breedlove, who talks about kind of some basic answers, basic questions in Bitcoin as well. So those two playlists are really good to send to friends and family. Also send them to swanbitcoin.com. I think it's the most user or noob friendly platform out there. We really do it the right way. We encourage your friends and family to set up an automatic stacking plan to dedicate a bit of their paycheck, their income every week, every month to Bitcoin. And you can now on swanbitcoin.com buy instantly as well. So if you want to top up your automatic recurring buy plan, you can do that on Swan now. We've seen, as you can imagine, a lot of usage of smash buys, of instant buys over the past few weeks or months since we launched it. So people trying to catch that dip and add to their regular recurring stack, you can do that now at swanbitcoin.com. All right, remember to like and subscribe to the channel, and we'll dive back into our discussion here. So let's move on to talking a little bit about some news that has happened recently. Well, very recently, just yesterday evening, late afternoon, I think Pacific time, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency dropped a note talking about stable coins and public ledgers, and I think they called it independent node verification is new language. I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on what you think that means. I mean, it's interesting. I think that they chose those words, obviously, very carefully. The note said at the top, national banks and federal savings associations, collectively referred to as banks in the note, may use new technologies, including INVNs, independent node verification networks, and related stable coins to perform bank permissible functions, such as payment activities. There's no mention specifically of projects here, and it does really stay talking about sticking to talking about stable coins, but it does talk, you know, more broadly about these independent node verification networks. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. You have written about in the book, Nick, about stable coins. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the meaning of this note from the OCC and the role that stable coins might be playing in our, you know, financial and monetary future.
Well, I actually was working on a last minute edition right before we went live. And I was reviewing the note because I think it is important. So this new independent node verification network moniker that they have, INVN, they use it to describe both cryptocurrencies and other distributed ledgers. So I think they wanted a catch-all phrase for anything that operates with a node structure where multiple people have the node and there's a degree of open access to that node. So, you know, in like Bitcoin is Bitcoin would be considered an independent node verification network because it's a network of nodes that can verify what's going on, and those nodes are independent. So it describes Bitcoin. And I think it's an important development. I don't love the INVN, but it makes sense from my perspective that they want to include, that they're really formalizing what a node is. And it shows a lot of progress in their understanding, that the U.S. government and the U.S. Treasury Department's understanding of what Bitcoin is and what other cryptocurrencies are, especially ones that use this node structure. So, and then they basically said that INVNs and stablecoins can both be used to transact value as long as banking laws are followed. So it really is a moment. It seems to be a momentous decision from the U.S. government to basically allow for a crypto-based financial rail, which is already being built. We know that it's already being built, but now there's going to be a legal framework in the United States for all of this to happen. I think this is the direction that we have been going, and I commend all of the people that have contributed to the legal understanding of these things so that regulations that come down actually reflect reality and not just politics and nonsense. So I'm really excited about this ruling, and I think it's a big deal.
Jan, your thoughts?
So I've only briefly read through the letter. I do think that I don't love them making up new terminology, but I recognize the requirement for government to do so to feel like they own the thing. I think this is a very common pattern. I mean, seriously, like no joke, they invent a word so that they could say, we came up with this concept and this is our framework for thinking about it. I think I agree with Nick there in the sense that they did describe it rather broadly, and it does probably include Bitcoin, because INVNs, I mean, yes, you can verify Bitcoin independently with a node. That's literally what you do with Bitcoin, right? So while they do talk primarily about stablecoins, I actually found that they referenced a CoinDesk article. Shout out to Zach for getting included in government literature, Zach Well. But the article was about that stablecoin volume was like eclipsing Bitcoin, and that people want stablecoins more than Bitcoin. And so it reads as, yeah, this Bitcoin thing is cool, but have you heard about these stable coins and how we can make it better for bank-to-bank transfers? Which, by the way, I have no problem with. I think if banks were to share a ledger and make their transfers faster, that would be great. In a sense, it's really just telling banks, hey, go use the technology of the day instead of like being on this ancient system that's really poorly designed and it's kind of legacy. So that's a good thing. I think the efficiency in banking is good. I think we stand to figure out where exactly Bitcoin fits into this and how the OCC views that. I believe a few months ago, we already heard that the OCC said that banks are now allowed to custody crypto, which would include Bitcoin. So it seems like they're coming out pretty friendly to this, and they're seeing that, US banks have to be playing this game, otherwise they're going to be left behind. And I think that's a very wise move. I expect that our government actually will become more friendly to Bitcoin over time, as we are now seeing senators and congressmen who have either embraced it openly or at least have said that they can't stop it, so we might as well join. I think we're seeing that kind of attitude from our government, which is really great, because I do think that Bitcoin could be a very powerful industry for America if we embrace it and allow it to grow. So I'm excited about this. I think it's saying that they're paying attention. I do see some call-outs in the letter around, money laundering risks and all that. And I think the one negative of this is that there's still this narrative around Bitcoin being this like dark market money, and that government somehow feels like they need to have really, really good surveillance over every transaction, which, to be frank, they want out of the traditional financial system as well, right? They're already talking about the $250 travel rule, which is basically saying if you send money abroad for $250, we want to know about it, which is to me a little bit absurd. And it starts to smack of some of these other countries that have serious capital controls, and then their economy just dies. So I hope we don't go that way, but I'm excited the government is starting to think about this and see the potential for new technology to change how we can do banking. I wish they had a more hands-off approach, but it is what it is. We live in a pretty, an increasingly, uh, law-oriented, I don't know, it's not totalitarian, but it's definitely starting to feel more like government wants to regulate absolutely everything under the sun when it touches money. And I tweeted about this today, but like AML laws are just extremely ineffective. Like all the research that's been done on it is just that they don't stop any crime, and instead is just exposing, you know, users to privacy breaches. And that's the real crime, is the identity theft has just become rampant due to government action. So I really hope they think about that and the trade-offs they're making when they're writing these letters.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It seems on the point of how the US government in particular is approaching Bitcoin, and we have seen very promising regulatory developments over the past year or so in terms of the government looking to integrate Bitcoin into the legacy financial system with clear regulations and et cetera. It does, I did note as well, like you did, Jan, the citation of the suggestion, I can't remember, it was the which organization was, FinCEN maybe, that suggested that countries need to, you know, use the, or I can't remember who it was. You guys will remember and you'll remind me, but the suggestion that came down a few weeks ago about unhosted wallets or being able to extend AML KYC to unhosted wallets, right? That was mentioned in this note. And I wonder if the government's going to approach regulating Bitcoin, like accept it open arms. Let's use it. This is a great technology. Like what the internet did for the American economy. We have the top X, you know, biggest internet companies based here. We want to have the top X Bitcoin based companies in this country, but we're going to do everything we can to strip out this notion of self-sovereignty and privacy. Nick, your thoughts on that concern?
Well, the wallet issue is a very important one, and it does come down to privacy and these freedom of speech archetypes that we have in the United States, and the court precedent that encryption is protected as free speech in the digital age. And so that is just an important battle. And I'm hopeful that the brilliant Bitcoiners around the country are submitting, you know, their opinions to make sure that regulation comes down in the right way and not with haste.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, first of all, yes, it's important to comment on these government open commenting procedures, even though they may be short-lived or ignored or have bugs in them. By the way, every time I try to comment on one of these sites, I have some kind of bug. Besides that, I also think there's a process through which Bitcoin just permeates the society, permeates government, all right? I mean, government is just other people. They're not special necessarily. So once it permeates enough, like we're seeing with congressmen and senators, I think we're going to have smarter people making smarter decisions. I also think, to be a little bit cynical, government is run by money, right? Corporations, big money ends up running government. And if Bitcoin is money and the biggest money of the future, then it stands to reason that the people with the Bitcoin are going to be the ones making the rules. So I think over time, and now again, it may be a generational thing, it may be 10, 20 years as government shifts out and people... sorry to say, but you know, they pass away due to their age, because our government is primarily made up of really old people at this point. once those people are out and the new blood is in with a Bitcoin in their pockets, I think we're going to have a very different approach to how government should be, just by the nature of the adoption of Bitcoin. That's my optimism.
Yeah. I mean, so do you see Bitcoin incentivizing governments to be less concerned about laws like AML KYC? The incentive is there for them to, like you said, leverage, you know, this, use the politics of fear to, you know, leverage terrorism, etc., the threat of all that stuff to really invade our privacy. Do you think that Bitcoin will somehow incentivize governments to want to invade privacy less, I guess?
I mean, I don't know. Governments have always used fear to control the population. That's kind of their thing. But I do think that once you become a quote unquote Bitcoiner or start holding Bitcoin and you see, hey, it's not all that bad. I'm not a criminal. The other person I'm transacting with is not a criminal. And there's a functioning economy and it's being used for all these very positive world changing use cases. Then you might actually have a different perspective on it. Maybe it's okay that we don't collect information on every single financial transaction. After all, that's how money worked for millennia. up until like the last 50 years when we started having the technology to do it, right? It's a very new concept that we should actually should be tracking every transaction. This was never a possibility, so it never crossed anybody's mind. I think that Bitcoin does offer us the ability to potentially go back to a system where money is money, people use money as they will, and crime is prosecuted for the crime and not, you know, the not monitored arbitrarily without search and seizure warrants. So I do think when people become more aware of Bitcoin as a force of good, and again, this could be a generational thing, it will change the nature of government.
Nick, you write a bit toward the end of your book about the separation of money and states, what that could mean for individual freedom. And I think this is a good time for you to talk about those ideas.
Yeah, you know, we've been associating money with government for several centuries now, and that trend might be reversing. And Bitcoin gives us the ability to reverse that trend. I don't think that government will leave money anytime soon. But the point is that now we have a freedom of currency denomination. And that's the conclusion of my book, is that the freedom of currency denomination is here. It's with us. And we can use that freedom to denominate our labor, our time in Bitcoin if we choose. And I do believe that that should be protected going into the future in the United States and elsewhere.
I also think there's this concept, you know, of a freedom of movement that Bitcoin gives us, which is you can leave a country that is, you know, a bad country, like one that oppresses your rights, that doesn't allow you to transact the way you want to, doesn't allow you to leave. At the end of the day, you know, people can escape these countries once their wealth is more portable, or once they can pay bribes in a hard money, like if they, you know, if they live in Venezuela or other places that have hyperinflated currencies, they can use Bitcoin to make their way out. So that creates a certain sort of like brain drain phenomenon, right? Which we saw happening. It happened in Iran and Russia and like all these, I'm from Russia, right? Like all the smart people who had the means and the wherewithal left Russia once the borders were opened up in like 89 or, you know, 79 prior to that. So we had small windows where we could escape, and anybody who could and who understood what was going on, they were like, oh, this is a bad country. We need to go to America, right? Why did they go to America? Because America offered them better freedom, better property rights, freedom to be who they wanted to be and do what they wanted to do. So if America, in fact, turns into the opposite of that and starts locking down more, or if any country does that, now that we have Bitcoin, people with the means and the wherewithal will leave. And that will create a brain drain for that country. It will create the amassing of really, you know, good people in the country that embraces Bitcoin. And so it's just going to be that kind of process. And through that process, again, through a long passage of time, the countries that don't embrace Bitcoin will, at the end of the day, suffer. Their industries will fall, their governments will fall, their currencies will devalue, and it'll be what it is. You know, they'll be struggling. So I really am optimistic for Bitcoin to give people that choice for the very first time. Because, you know, when we left Russia, we had to leave like our money behind because there were capital controls. So we couldn't take US dollars with us. We were allowed $100 a person. I'm very optimistic that Bitcoin has changed that narrative now, where if you want to leave a country and it's no good for you, then go. As long as, you know, you have some freedom of movement. Some countries are very authoritarian and lock down their borders even, but that's not by far all of them.
I love listening to Jan talk about Bitcoin and freedom, because it comes from a place deep in his heart, a real lived experience. And I think it's hard for us in the Western world and the United States to really understand that there is another very important use case for Bitcoin. And that is to provide a way to opt out of authoritarian regimes and capital controls and lock border lockdowns and be able to take your capital, your wealth with you and not have it seized. That is a revolution in freedom, monetary freedom, that is hard to appreciate if you don't come from a country like Russia in the 1980s, like Jan did. So I think I just love listening to Jan talk about that. And I think it's very important. And you can check out more of Jan's thoughts on Bitcoin, including freedom, in his book, Inventing Bitcoin. We have two Bitcoin authors with us today. Jan's book is an introduction to the Bitcoin system, but also talks about why Bitcoin is important and talks about his story. SwanBitcoin.com/free book. Jan has been kind enough to give it away to all of our Swan fans and customers. So grab that and give it away. Give it away, free Bitcoin education to friends and family. Okay, well, let's finish up. We're about out of time here. So let's finish up, Nick, talking about the prospects of central bank digital currencies. And you lay out this idea that that nations will create their own digital currency that is based on a blockchain or a distributed ledger or an INVN. And they will be able to issue money basically directly to people, bypass treasuries or any sort of kind of relationship between the actual democratic institutions in this country in particular and this, you know, private Federal Reserve Bank. What are the, first of all, what can you just summarize the status of CBDCs around the world now? What nations are looking at doing or already have done?
Sure. And I have to call it in a few seconds because I have to go pick up my daughter.
No worries. We can close it up right here then.
Yeah. The status is that they're all in development. They're all researching them. And we don't know exactly what they're going to look like. But I do give some ideas in my book about how some countries will do a retail thing, like in China, where people can use it. Some will do a wholesale to start. Maybe like in the United States, where the Fed does a Fed Reserve coin for banks to use to test their technology. But I do believe that they're all coming.
All right, Nick, I'll let you go so you can pick up your daughter.
Thanks, guys.
We are Bitcoin maximalists here, but we're also family maximalists. So thanks for joining, man. We'll wrap it up.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, take care. All right.
Yeah.
John, thanks for joining, man. Yeah, go ahead. No,
it's great. I would echo Nick. I was researching this a little bit with my talk when I talked to Eric Townsend from Macro Voices, and we had a chat about CBDCs. I think, pretty much every country that matters is either like in progress or researching CBDCs. I think what that really creates is like kind of a twofold carrot and stick thing where they can start to offer something like UBI, right? It's very easy for us to say, okay, if you want to have our new UBI system, Universal Basic Income, if you want to claim your $2,000 check, it's very easy. Go to this website, sign up for an account, download this wallet, and now you have this like central bank digital currency. And some countries have already done this. I believe that they did this in Venezuela with the Petro, where they gave it to people as a quote unquote bonus, which is essentially like a UBI. And they said, here, you can have these coins, enjoy them, but now we get to track you, right? So the carrot is you get free money. The stick is like now we get to track everywhere it goes afterwards. And I think that accomplishes a lot of goals for government because it allows them to distribute money as helicopter money, which I think the Treasury wants to do very badly, especially in the times of like a crisis like Corona. So it gives them that technology, and it also gives them the ability to track everybody and make sure that nobody's being a money laundering terrorist or child pornographer or whatever thing they're going to scare you with. So it's not a great system to me. I mean, it's good in a sense because, if you're going to spend money like arbitrarily and drop it on people, maybe it's kind of nice to be able to actually drop it to real people rather than just making it cheap for like, Michael Saylor to buy $1 billion of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Which,
nothing against that. That's great too. But once these UBI systems are implemented, I think you get into a very kind of dystopian future where, every transaction is easily tracked and China's doing this already. Other banks are going to do this. I think what does give me hope is that even though these systems may be implemented and even though I do think it's going to happen, and I think they're going to get embraced by regular people, we now have Bitcoin. So at least at the very least, you can also have a side pot of Bitcoin, which is true freedom money, which isn't being funneled through these tracking systems, and that you can actually take out of your country. Because remember, the other thing about like a centralized UBI or a centralized CBDC type of system is that they can press a button and like make your entire account invalid very easily, which they can probably do now. I mean, your bank can freeze your account, but it's a little bit harder for the government. They still have to go through the warrants and the court orders and all that. But with CBDCs, I mean, they press a button and they're done. So I think that people are going to become aware of that, and they're going to start building their Bitcoin stashes because they want the optionality on a real savings account that doesn't get debased and that is actually freedom money.
Yeah. And it still remains that the dollar is not a store of value anymore. So that function has been taken out, and it's really just a currency. It's just a means of payment at this point. And so Bitcoin can easily exist alongside central bank digital currencies, at least for quite some time, as a store of value. And as it becomes more established, more trusted in that regard, then people will naturally just want to start getting paid in Bitcoin and paying in Bitcoin, you know, demanding Bitcoin as payment. Because it's more trusted money, and who knows like what government fuckery is going to happen to their Fed coins, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think if anything, once you give government more centralized control, there's more chance they're going to screw it up, right? It's already very centralized with what the Fed does, but it's not perfectly centralized. With a CBDC, it's so centralized where like the power is all concentrated. And, you know, I'm not even ascribing malice to the government. I'm just saying like another coronavirus happens and they're asked by their constituents, we need money right now. We need it right now. Press that button. And they go and press that button, right? Or we are being attacked by, you know, terrorists and money launderers. Press that button. Stop these payments. That stuff happens, right? So it just gives them more power to screw it up. And there's a great piece of research that I like to cite by a company called Winton. I think they're a hedge fund. They did a study on black market currencies. And this was really close to home because I read about what happened in Soviet Russia. And this, I wasn't aware of this, but it turns out that like 40 or 50% of payments in Russia were made by US dollars at the time where it was completely illegal to own them, like go to jail illegal. Wow. Like the most of the economy ran on that. In certain cases, like in rural areas, like just everything was done in US dollars. If you wanted anything of value, like an apartment or your car fix, it was all done in US dollars. And what they show in this paper is that every time a government comes in with really tight capital controls, tries to combat this black market currency, if the black market currency is stronger, it ends up just forcing the government's hand. They end up having to devalue their currency against this other black market currency, and eventually these governments tend to fall. Just because you can hide the truth for, you know, only so long, but money leaks out of your country, right? It's even more true with Bitcoin because it can leak out instantly over the internet, whereas with other things, like you'd have to have, you know, hide a suitcase of USD and try to walk out of the country with it. It's really hard to do. With Bitcoin, trivial. So I do think the force of the CBDCs is going to end up having governments screw up their systems even more, just because they're going to want to do more things, which do, you know, more capital controls. And the harder currency always wins. And that's what we're going to see.
That's where we're headed. The game theory works out, and we've seen it proven throughout history. We know that the money pushes out the bad, just a matter of time. All right, Jan, this was great. Let's take a second, since we have you on, to get an update from you about Swan, about the product, about how the business is going, and as a co-founder, how you're feeling about Swan.
Feeling extremely Swanish.
Swanish, me too.
That's what we say. I mean, when we launched Swan, we really thought, you know, we wanted to bring out the next 10 million Bitcoiners, and that progress is going very nicely. We're definitely acquiring lots and lots of users, lots and lots of savers. We like to call people savers who are, you know, saving into Bitcoin on a recurring basis. We recently launched our Smash Buys and the ability to fund accounts by wire, which has been very, very popular. One thing that I didn't see coming this year, which came really kind of out of the blue with probably MicroStrategy leading the effort to start doing corporate treasury, is we now have a lot of accounts who want to do corporate treasury for private businesses, smaller businesses, mom and pop shops, corporations of all kinds, people with trusts or checkbook LLCs who are thinking about saving Bitcoin for their retirement, or putting away for their children. We're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of big money come in really at any price at this point, just saying, I need exposure to Bitcoin right now. I need to save this for my children. I need it for my corporation. So that came a little bit out of left field, but I'm very excited about it as a development for Bitcoin's narrative, as a store of value, and as a savings technology, and as a product for people who want to think about value over a much longer time period. These are definitely not people that are coming in today to sell at a, you know, a 10% pump, which is what we saw in 2017 as everybody's buying and selling and trading for alts. Right now, it's a very different process. It's people buying with a multi-generational wealth mindset, with thinking about it as a money for the future. And I'm very excited that Swan is a part of that journey, and that we're helping those folks onboard their trusts and their corporations, and you know, coming in size. And so I'm excited to do more developments on that front to help those people really get to the next level.
Likewise, my friend, it's been an honor and a pleasure to work alongside you on Swan. And it's amazing to see the growth and the amazing team that you and Corey have been able to build. So grab your free book of a free copy of Jan's book, Inventing Bitcoin, at swanbitcoin.com/freebook. Share it far and wide with family and friends. I know you're getting a lot of questions as the person who knows about Bitcoin in your circle of friends and family. So you can direct them to swanbitcoin.com/freebook. Send them our way to start buying Bitcoin. I think it's the best way for a new coiner to get involved because we do it the right way. We follow Bitcoin best practices and the Bitcoin ethos. So thanks so much again for joining us today for the first Swan Signal Live of 2012. Got another great one next week with Lynn Alden and Jeff Booth. So that's going to be fantastic. Both of them will have dropped some recent articles. Jeff's already has dropped, and I hear that Lynn is going to be dropping one just before that show. So we'll have plenty to talk about. We'll see you next week. Oh, before I forget, yes, I almost forgot. We're doing something new. We're trying something out. We have been really enjoying this new app called Clubhouse. It's describes itself as drop-in audio. It's kind of like talk radio for the digital age. It's an audio-only social network. It's really cool. There are more and more Bitcoiners moving over there and a lot of discussion happening about Bitcoin, which I love to see because it was just, you know, altcoin scams and crypto investors. But now a lot of Bitcoin talk is moving over there, and I think people are really appreciating that. So we're going to do a room right after the show with some of the Swan team, including Jan and myself. And you can hop on stage and comment, question. So you can grab that app at Clubhouse. .io or get joinclubhouse.com. I can't remember. Just search Clubhouse, drop in audio. You'll find it. If you're already on Clubhouse, come join us. And that's it for today. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks, Jan. Appreciate it.
Joinclubhouse.com is the link.
Joinclubhouse.com. There you go. Thank you.
Come join us. Follow Corey Clipson. Follow me, and we'll get you in the room.
All right. Thanks all. Thank you to Nick and Jan for joining us today. You can find Nick on Twitter at Time Value of BTC, TimeValue of BTC. And Jan is at SKWP. I am at Citizen Bitcoin, and you'll find Swan at Swan Bitcoin. On behalf of the Swan team, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Swan Signal podcast. It is a ton of fun to join us live on the YouTube broadcasts at youtube.com/swansignal. Head over there, subscribe to the channel, turn on notifications. We have a lot of fun in the live chat during these broadcasts, and we often work in some questions from listeners. Remember to check out also, while you're there, Bitcoin TV. We have a 24/7 stream of the best Bitcoin content on the web. You can throw Bitcoin TV on your TV at home or at the office and have a constant stream. We also have the price ticker running down below the video, so it's a lot of fun to have up during your day. You can subscribe to this podcast, if you're not already, at swansignalpodcast.com. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com. The safest and easiest way to get into Bitcoin, start stacking some sats, and accumulate the best money history has ever known.